In 72 Kenosha, 68 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very pleased that we can begin the week with Dr. Art Sear, who is Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, a frequent visitor to WUWM up in Milwaukee, and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country, and he is a monthly visitor to the morning show to offer his thoughts on kind of an array of different issues and concerns. And not surprisingly, top of the list in terms of current concerns is the situation in Afghanistan. And that's where we are going to begin our morning show conversation today. But we will also be talking about the recently completed Olympic Games in Japan. And we'll also be talking about this enormous infrastructure bill on Capitol Hill and the significance that that such a bill will have in terms of all of our lives and as well, of course, as well as impact on the nation as a whole should everything ultimately pass. So we have a lot to get to, actually, even if we limit ourselves to just those three topics. But who knows what tangents we might explore. Dr. Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's a tough job, but I know you can handle it, and I follow your lead as always, and it's always a pleasure as well as educational to be here, so thank you. I don't always get invited back. Not everybody is as positive about yours truly as I am, and you are, so thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you here. Glad to have you here, and I do want to say at the outset that I do intend to issue an invitation to your faculty colleague, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, to talk about this first topic which we're going to be exploring, namely Afghanistan. He knows a great deal about that region and about kind of the history of our presence there, as well as the presence of the former Soviet Union. So this
great resource.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether you agree with our friend or not.
Yes.
No, he's a great resource and very, very intelligent.
Right. So let's talk about this withdrawal. And it's interesting because you yourself wrote about Afghanistan and the impending withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. You wrote about this back, I think, in late June. And at that point in time, although by no means was anything certain, and you were careful to say that, there were at least some hopeful signs. And you had written about, actually, some of the amazement that there were actually peace talks there, and that there was at least reason for hope. And of course, since then, the situation has changed so drastically. Where would you say are the most what are the most important reasons for the situation there changing as drastically as it did?
Well, to be brief, it's never easy for me, but that's a very important question. I think the most important point is that Afghanistan is not really a nation state in the Western sense, or in the sense of Japan and South Korea today and other. The nation state is spreading around the world. It is a collection of tribes and tribal leaders. And that's a fundamental reality. The national government was too corrupt, with 2020 hindsight, too corrupt and too ineffective to change that fact of life.
And
and that was brief, so
right,
not easy for me.
Very good. But that does really does get to the heart of it. And of course, I think this is one of the things that President Biden talked about in his address to the nation about Afghanistan, that ultimately this always came down to the Afghan government and what it could or could not do. And ultimately, that government, in a sense, fell apart. Can you kind of, as you understand it, talk us through kind of the events of that, in terms of the government and the rise of the Taliban? I mean, kind of how that sequence of events occurred.
Well, I'm not an expert on Afghan history, and another good reason to have Professor Maltsev on here. The British tried very hard throughout the 19th century, the 1800s, something that's not much mentioned by the media, which is a good reason for bringing it up. They lost one entire army in the 1830s, literally. One man survived, and as he approached British ships on the shore and some distance away in South Asia, the men there assumed it was a messenger coming back with an update. He was, in fact, was the only survivor, a doctor, I believe, who was allowed to live by the tribal warriors because they wanted the word to get back to Britain. The British, through a combination of bribery, some social services to the population, diplomatic influence, and occasional military action, were able to exercise influence in Afghanistan without trying to turn it into one more colony of their empire. They did withdraw in 1919 after the terrible costs of World War I, and because it was just too vexing to try to maintain a continuing relationship. So there was a period of national independence. I don't know the details of that history. Russia and the Soviet Union always exercised considerable influence thanks to their proximity geographically. And there was a very sympathetic pro-communist government after World War II in Afghanistan. The Soviets decided that wasn't enough, and they invaded in 1979 and were there for about a decade. And again, much less sophisticated, much more heavy-handed, much more brutal effort on their part compared to the British, but it was the same result. They finally admitted defeat and left. My understanding from various people, including visitors on public radio, is that you can still see in Afghanistan these large Soviet, heavy Soviet helicopters, their heavy tanks, burned out wrecks all over the country along highways, but also dotting the countryside, showing just how long and significant that war was. Jimmy Carter, as well as Ronald Reagan, deserve a lot of credit for supporting the Mujahideen and in playing a crucial role, especially Reagan's providing Stinger missiles, very inexpensive, very lethal, anti-helicopter, anti-aircraft weapons that can also be used against tanks and other vehicles. That was really important in finally driving the Soviets out and overcoming their technology as well as numbers.
Right.
The Taliban took over in, I think, 1996, and were fully in charge because they had the support of tribal leaders, at least enough to stay in power until 9/11, shortly thereafter, an international coalition led by NATO, led by us, but with NATO support and sanctioned, that is, approved and endorsed by the United Nations, overthrew the Taliban government. So that's the capsule history. It is important, though. I always appreciate your emphasis on the historical dimension.
Right. So as we're in the midst of this really messy and painful situation, it is important to remember that we entered Afghanistan a long time ago, 20 long years ago. Do you think, hindsight 2020, do you think it was that a mistake, or was that something we simply had to do?
Yes, we had to go in and overthrow the Taliban. I think it was a mistake, and have felt this way for some years, for us to remain and try to, in good old good guy American fashion, endorsed by many, many Europeans and the European Union, in effect, to try to build a democracy in Afghanistan. That was a big mistake. And Richard Armitage, former Deputy Secretary of State, when Colin Powell was Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration, two men I admire a great deal. Armitage, it's well worth seeking out that interview with him this morning.
On NPR.
Yeah. He talks with some feeling and direct experience about the misguided nature of our long-term occupation of Afghanistan, especially given the history that you and I have just reviewed. He also mentioned that after President Bush decided to invade Iraq, his inbox, he said, got more and more filled up with Iraq, and we effectively forgot about Afghanistan, which tends to be an American failure. I in no way condone or defend, obviously, what Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, did. But they were our allies during the anti-Soviet war, and in characteristic American fashion, we kind of absentmindedly moved on to other things after the Soviets withdrew. Mm. You don't need 20/20 hindsight to see that as having been a mistake, and that does characterize our approach to the world, I believe, in contrast especially to our British friends,
right,
who, whatever their shortcomings and ethnocentrism, they have a well-organized diplomatic machine as well as tradition, and they stay involved with a remarkably large number of parts of the world. We're
right.
A little different.
Right. We're not maybe quite as relentless with our focus.
Well, we certainly can be relentless, especially in military terms, but we tend not to be naturally engaged even now diplomatically with other parts of the world.
And, of course, chances are we also, from the beginning, did not fully appreciate the nature of Afghanistan itself.
Quite right.
And that's probably also an American failing that we've seen more than once. One of the things you mention in your most recent column about Afghanistan is the fact that in this most recent, I'm sorry, not the most recent presidential, well, or was it this most recent presidential campaign, Donald Trump was one of the planks of his platform, in effect, was that he was going to get America out of Afghanistan. Was that when he was running against Hillary Clinton, or was that
more recently? I
think it
was both. It's been a sustained theme that we're overcommitted in the world and we should get out. And as President Biden mentioned in his brief address to the nation last week that you referred to, he pointed out that President Trump had gotten this agreement, which involved direct negotiations starting early last year with the Taliban, but the Afghanistan government was not involved. It was very much a rush job, anxious to get out. At the same time, it has been particularly chaotic. It's been the reverse of standard procedure and also common sense that our military would leave first, our civilians, many thousands of them still stuck. I think that underscores the point that at the top, we doubted that Afghanistan would fall so quickly. It is quite stunning.
Right. One of the main points of your column is that if there is any significant takeaway from this situation, it is the major intelligence failure on behalf of the United States. So take us inside what you see as an intelligence failure, and how do you imagine that failure occurred, or how is such a thing possible?
Well, now that disaster has unfolded, we will all note, I'm sure, in the news that anonymous intelligence officials are leaking to the press very actively that we warned the administration that this would happen, and there have been released to the press very quickly, previously confidential, memoranda by email to the State Department from diplomats there saying that there's a very good chance the government will fall immediately. The intelligence failure is at the top, as the president said in his most recent address, inspired by Harry Truman, as president should be, the buck stops with me. Obviously, they didn't foresee that the collapse would occur so quickly. And you also, the Pentagon especially, but government agencies generally, they spend a great deal of time planning and speculating about all kinds of possibilities, partly for reasons of bureaucratic self-protection, as we see in operation right now, but also because they have to look to all kinds of different eventualities. In that sense, we have a very good, as well as professional, intelligence and defense establishment. But as an outsider, I think it's self-evident to say this was a failure to see what would happen.
Okay.
I hope that's clarifying.
Well, let me...
Because I've gotten some emails complaining about my... referring to intelligence failures, when we intelligence professionals, we'll have you know, have actually, you know, on and on.
Mm. Well, I guess the thing I'm trying to understand is, because it sounds like there's two different things. It's either our intelligence failed us in the sense that we did not foresee this or did not understand the reality on the ground, or the intelligence was saying that, but we failed to listen to what our intelligence
was telling us. I believe it is more of the latter, and I also believe strongly, however, speaking as an outsider, that this dimension was not emphasized forcefully.
Mm.
Biden himself has been very skeptical of international involvements, and he's made very clear that this was his decision, and whenever we withdrew, there would be problems. He also has been very directly critical of the Afghan military, which I believe was... bad form and a mistake in terms of speaking about our ally, a number of whom are being killed at the moment, as they have been for some years. But Biden entered the Senate at the precocious age of 30 in the 72 election as part of a wave of younger, mostly Democrats, not exclusively, who were very much opposed to the Vietnam War. He did not favor the so-called surge that the Obama administration initiated early on to prevent collapse of Afghanistan in 79. But temperamentally, he seems to be part of that generation of the Vietnam era of politicians who were very skeptical about overseas involvement. I think that's a fact that is important to keep in mind as the president and his top officials continue to try to maneuver through this particular latest disaster.
Right.
Echoes of Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, at least in the Chicago Tribune, your column about Afghanistan is accompanied by a photo with, I think it's called a Chinook helicopter that's kind of hovering over one of our diplomatic centers in Kabul. But it certainly brings back memories of some of the unsettling images from 1975 in Saigon.
Yeah.
Does this represent something similar? And is it a mistake to draw too many parallels between how we left Vietnam and how we left Afghanistan?
No. I greatly admire John Mearsheimer, a, quote, realist, unquote, political scientist at the University of Chicago, who, in fact, I cite a principal book of his most recent book, I believe, in a column on Afghanistan quite recently. He tends to be very skeptical of these overseas involvements that are not driven by immediate national security needs and emphasize nation building and our quintessentially American, rather grandiose, misguided view that other people want to be like us and we can reproduce ourselves elsewhere in the world. That really is a long theme, not just lately, in American government and politics. In 73, the Congress overwhelmingly voted to prohibit the administration, at that point the Nixon administration, from any air or ground support for the Republic of Vietnam.
later on that year, and over President Nixon's veto, they passed the War Powers Act, which severely restricts, I think, to about 60 days, any substantial use of American force overseas in a conflict zone without congressional authorization. That's remained controversial. I don't think it's been tested in the Supreme Court, but administrations generally have respected that and gone to Congress. So hands were tied in 70 during the Vietnam era in a way that they're not today. James Schlesinger, Secretary of Defense, as Saigon was falling in April 75, he called Henry Kissinger, quite wisely, Secretary of State, and got him on board. He tried to reach President Ford and was unable to do so. James Schlesinger, on his own authority, authorized and ordered a massive, all stops pulled out, a massive airlift and extrication of people from South Vietnam who wanted to leave, and we were able to extricate about 40,000, most of whom went to Guam, I believe. Mm. As Armitage said on the radio this morning, rescue your friends and allies, that's vital. Get your people out of there. Not just Americans, but your close allies who have fought for you and who may be killed. Get them out. I think what Schlesinger did is what we should be doing now and what we haven't done. We've been very, very bureaucratic, very slow moving. I respect our senior officials, but what the Secretary of Defense currently and Joint Chiefs Chairman Miley have been saying is far more cautious and far more bureaucratic. I had some passing contact with Dr. Schlesinger when I was quite young. I found him quite imperious, arrogant, forceful, impressive, the kind of guy who was not necessarily going to come across well on public radio, but he deserves tremendous respect, along with Kissinger and Ford, who Hawk endorsed the move to doing what America can do. We have tremendous, vast, almost unlimited logistical and support capacities, and that's what we should have been doing as soon as Afghanistan started to fall, since you brought up Vietnam. So I'm going on at length as usual, but on this point I feel very strongly.
Right.
And it's not just Monday morning quarterbacking or some professor on the sidelines.
Right. So in other words, we need to be doing in Afghanistan more of what we were doing in those closing days in Vietnam.
And we're not limited the way the Ford administration was.
Interesting.
The human dimension was so important that carping critics, mostly but not all Democrats in Congress, left Schlesinger alone, even though at some level he may have been violating the spirit and specifics of that 73 legislation. The administration isn't tied down the way the Nixon and Ford people were.
So what would you guess is holding them back from being more aggressive in this?
Well, we're now being more aggressive. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt, but we are being more aggressive, and I saw in the news this morning about 10,000 Americans have been, I believe, already extricated, so our giant machine is in motion.
But I guess what you're saying then is it really should have been in motion right from the start.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a hesitant beginning.
Exactly, and the buck stops at the White House. I mean, it started with the president, who involves himself in details, to be sure. I'm confident in what I speak. The media image, the Fox News media image of an older, disengaged old guy is not really accurate. But it was very, very misguided to adopt the tone and do what he failed to do. On a more positive note, I have not seen any reports of any Americans being killed. Some may have been. There's tremendous chaos and phenomenal photo ops and phenomenal film opportunities for news people and media people who have a vested interest in promoting bad news, chaos, and disorder. But I don't believe any Americans have been killed. And that's a fact to pay attention to, that kind of item. The second main point is there is an infrastructure there, including educated women, 30% of the civil service in the Afghan government. And the Taliban needs these people if they're going to exist in today's world. 30% are women. There are pervasive cell phones. There's pervasive external investment. there are lots of things that will limit the Taliban in terms of what they can do in terms of their most ugly and brutal characteristics, as long as we stay involved and stay engaged.
Right. So you do want that continued engagement.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things you do talk about in your column, however, is that there are widespread calls for the United States to actually send in more troops and attempt to overthrow the Taliban. You call that, I think, if I remember your wording, a major blunder. That would be a major blunder.
That would be, yes.
Tell us why.
Do you want to go back to war in Afghanistan? The American people clearly don't. And I think it would be self-defeating. A big reason why the government fell is the foreign troops and the characteristics of the national government in Afghanistan turned off the local warlords. But again, it's not a nation state. There are lots of opportunities for us using human agents. It's why the British experience in the 1800s is so instructive, using human agents, not just our preferred electronic surveillance, and using human interaction on the ground, holding back on the kind of drone strikes that have become, I'm sorry to say, an addiction of the U.S. government in this century, and maintain influence the old-fashioned way.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear, who is Colossian Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, and a monthly visitor to The Morning Show. And we, of course, have been talking about the situation in Afghanistan. What would you guess is going to be the political cost to President Biden in terms of the way that this has been handled and mishandled?
I think it will hurt him politically. I think the Republicans, unless there's another sea change, will do quite well in the midterm elections next year. And we'll have to see how congressional hearings unfold. The fact that Nancy Pelosi and I believe Chuck Schumer are quite have not been publicly strongly resisting having immediate hearings on what went wrong, I think that shows the kind of negative sentiment that's accruing.
Interesting. Let's talk about the infrastructure proposal, this immense proposal. And one of the things I appreciated about your column that kind of explored this is that you want to help all of us kind of understand the way in which this proposal, when it comes down to, you know, the myriad details in it, really would have a gigantic impact on us as, you know, collectively as a nation, but also on each of us in terms of just our individual lives. What a big difference this would make. Why don't you outline some of the major points of the significance of this, besides just its overall size, which we can all see from reading the headlines?
A lot of it is maintaining the status quo that we all take for granted. What would life be like if you had to go across several states to visit grandma by car and did not have the interstate highway system, or if you didn't have the chance to pop on and off to run errands or get to work, even if it's not a really long distance? We can thank Dwight Eisenhower for that. In the 1950s, he initiated and carried through the interstate highway system under the heading of defense and national security, which was a brilliant move at the time. Intellectuals and media people of that era often characteristically would sneer at good old Ike, kind of drawing simple-minded analogies to the Third Reich and World War II. The Nazi Germany had a phenomenal world-class highway system that was extremely vital to their war effort, especially during their desperate last year of the war, and which American GIs, not just scholars and government people, saw firsthand only a decade after World War II. That imagery resonated very much with people. It was also the height of the Cold War, and he talked about the need to be as prepared as possible in case of a general war and the Soviets invaded the United States, which might seem simplistic on the surface, but wasn't at all, because he was taking advantage of anti-communist sentiment, which was, quite rightly, in my view, very strong during that period. Also, more than half the federal budget in those days was the defense budget. Despite our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, and the enormous political power of the military-industrial complex, our defense spending is now under 30%. So very shrewdly, as usual, for defensible reasons that weren't at all simple-minded, Eisenhower put in place this vast network that is vital today, not to national defense — that was never his main motive — but to our very important national economic and social life and our very powerful economy. Since the 90s, there's been strong pressure to repair this system. And it's because the network really does need comprehensive repair and upgrading that Congress has finally acted. Mm. Now, Washington being Washington, they're throwing in all kinds of things, child care and all kinds of social benefits, and that's inevitable in our political system. There are also some useful ancillary benefits. My understanding is that really pursuing internet service and accessibility for very low-income people in rural areas is part of this omnibus bill, and that's fine. But it's a need to upgrade our basic infrastructure.
Right. You mentioned in the column that one of the items in this bill that you're glad is there is apparently some provisions to upgrade our whole network of cybersecurity.
Yeah.
And, of course, that seems like something that in this day and age is becoming an increasingly urgent concern.
Yes, it is, but it's also, and has been for some time, a significant part of our, a noticeable part of our still very, very substantial defense budget. And I'm on various, I get, as do we all nowadays, I get email alerts about defense and military security concerns, and I assure you the hills are alive, the highways are flowing electronically and literally. Defense consultants, companies that specialize in the security dimensions of cyber, they're everywhere and all over the place. And it's mainly a matter of sorting out those who actually will earn at least some of the big money they're being paid.
Mm, right.
But this bill will give a boost to all this vital activity, which is essential to a modern post-industrial economy. If you can't have ease of pervasive transactions, you are not going to be as strong or as prosperous as you should be. And I think that's the real motive. I don't downplay cybersecurity, but most important and central, as Ike understood with the highways in the 50s, is transactions, transportation, shipping, and communication that's central to our economy.
Hmm. I guess I've always assumed that year after year after year there was money to repair the interstate highways, that that would just be kind of a matter of course. And is it that they would do just as little as possible and just here and there? Or I mean, are infrastructure bills not a typical part of what the government does? I mean, what makes this so different? Is it because we just haven't done this in a long, long time?
Inspired by Ike and maybe Ronald Reagan, you build a foundation for your house, and then you build the structure of the house. You have to do constant repair work. You need new windows. You need a new roof. At some point, the foundation will need some basic maintenance and restructuring. I'm not an expert on training. I hope that's clear. I think that's a good way to communicate. We need some basic foundational work now. The states all have highway funds, I believe, mandated by the federal government, and they tend to be separate from the regular budget. Governor Walker got in some political trouble, quite rightly, when he tried to invade the highway funds for general spending in the state. Both Illinois and Wisconsin, early in this century, got hung up politically because of the difficulty of really comprehensive work on highways. Mike Pence deserves credit, as I mentioned it in editorial not long ago, for putting together a comprehensive transportation plan from Indiana that had for Indiana, which had some glitches, but I think was probably one reason why Trump picked him as his running mate in 2016. Hmm. Anything comprehensive is very hard to do in our system.
One of the points that you explore in your column about the infrastructure bill takes us into the way in which the United States is sometimes portrayed, particularly by media and even by politicians, as in decline. And you take serious exception to that. And I just want you to explain the connection between that and the infrastructure bill, how one relates to the other.
Why do you think the two are connected?
Well, I'm not sure. That's why I was
okay.
I'm just trying to find. Here's what you say. Think of our infrastructure as reinforcing and strengthening literally the foundations of the American economy, which is the largest, richest, and most influential on our planet. Please keep that in mind. Today's nonstop media and almost nonstop politicians talk constantly about our alleged weakness and even decline.
Ah, thank you for quoting me. And I was just quoting myself, sort of, so at least I'm fairly consistent. Thank you, young man.
Yeah.
As long as I've been alive, which is now quite a while, we've been in decline. China is the current 800-pound gorilla bearing down on us and causing all kinds of trouble. China is a rival. I don't think there'll be a general war. We did fight a war with China, the Korean War, in the early 50s. A lot of people forget. But they are a major rival, and they do have geopolitical ambitions that conflict with our own interests and that of many other nations. Reel back to the 1990s, Japan was bearing down, and the 80s especially, Japan was bearing down on us, and they were our principal rival and competitor. Japan is no longer seen by the media or the public or politicians generally as a great threat to the U.S. China is a little different, but in many ways our economies are complementary in contrast to the U.S. and Japan. Because of the heavy-handed intervention of the government with tech companies and this growing censorship, stock prices are already declining among not just in China but globally for Chinese companies. Because today's fine students are so audiovisual, I respond to that, but I also get even by showing them old films and old videos, and I commend to you Executive Suite from 1955, a wonderful drama, where gender relations, believe it or not, are quite important. The pivotal characters are all female. I also show them the 1960 debate, the first of four, between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon, and the emphasis there was the Soviet Union, and Kennedy quite effectively developed this theme that the Soviets are in effect going to bury us if we don't get going. As the U.S., why does the U.S. continue to survive and prosper, even though as long as I've been around, we've been beleaguered and in decline?
Hmm. So connect that to the infrastructure bill. I mean, do you see the infrastructure bill as essential to
the largest and most powerful economy in the world? That has a direct bearing on our ability to defend ourselves. And the old-fashioned totalitarian dictatorships of the 20th century were essentially self-defeating. Japan and China have restrictions and limitations that, so far at least, the U.S. doesn't have. Having a robust economy is essential to that. I was trying to make this point, obviously not clearly enough, referring to Eisenhower and his very skillful, successful innovation of the highway system in the 50s. He used national defense. In point of fact, it strengthened our economy. Mm. Both are related. Does that help clarify things?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Is it? Okay.
And I guess just the dimension of our infrastructure is one source of our strength, but we have to safeguard it.
Yes, that's right. And that's quite right. Yeah, you sum it up very well. Thank you.
Let's finish up by talking about the recently completed Olympic Games in Tokyo, Japan. And you call them a great success, and you really applaud you applaud Japan for going ahead with them. And, of course, you're acknowledging the fact that there were fairly widespread calls for the Games to once again be postponed. I mean, they should have occurred last summer, and, of course, were postponed to 2021 and so on. And you discuss it at length, the Prime Minister of Japan, who apparently was really instrumental in these Games going ahead. And I think you characterize this as, you know, one more demonstration of kind of his character and maybe even personality in the face of a challenge.
Yes, Prime Minister Suga deserves great credit. There was tremendous pressure, including within Japan, to postpone the Games. At least, I believe the emperor, one must be particularly careful when discussing emperors in Japan or Britain or elsewhere, but I believe the emperor, in his way, at one point suggested publicly that they might be postponed. Suga forged ahead. His predecessor and mentor, Prime Minister Abe, think Roosevelt, Kennedy, an enormously powerful, not dynasty, certainly not in the case of the Kennedys, but enormously powerful and influential family. Abe comes from an established, highly influential, Japanese political family of great influence. Whether or not an Abe is prime minister. Suga, think more Harry Truman, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, an individual who starts from very modest means and through sheer determination and hard work gets to the top. That's Suga. He worked as a factory worker when he was quite young to save his enough money for university. Very American in that sense and admirable in any culture. He's a man of great willpower and determination, and in my opinion, he was quite right to go ahead with this. There is an international example. If you stand up to difficulty, if you stand up to a very serious public health challenge, if you show courage, especially when there is a lot of fear on the scene, that's better in the long run. What he did was not irresponsible. It wasn't crazy. It didn't lead to the public health or economic collapse of Japan. It was a rightly restricted set of games, but the basic lesson of the Olympics, international cooperation and triumph over adversity, is something that Americans especially, given our culture and founding, should relate to. And I tried to communicate that. I admire the way he and the many, many, many people in Japan and elsewhere who were responsible for this Olympics carried on. That's the way to do it. And there's a lesson for all of us in our own work environment, especially when people are very fearful. Fear can kill you. Fear can kill an enemy. You don't have to be in a combat zone for it to happen. Fear can disable you. We've all seen this. Every single person listening to this program has seen and witnessed this and experienced some of this. I know I have. But you face it and you fight, and eventually you'll do better. I hope that's clear.
Yeah. One thing I have read about the Tokyo Olympic Games is that they were incredibly expensive. And my understanding is far more expensive than they originally were supposed to be.
No doubt.
And the fact that there essentially were no spectators paying admission to see anything means that I assume they did not have the revenue stream coming in that they would have had if these had been more normal games. So there's a big bill for Japan to pay for these games.
Yes. Well, I hope that doesn't make you too fearful. And you can pay the bills as long as you've got economic growth. And thanks to the interstate highway system, the U.S. remains a powerful nation with tremendous strength in our economy.
Right. I did want to take just a couple of minutes. That's all that remains, I'm afraid, to acknowledge the fact that that we are speaking on the one-year anniversary of the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, and of course, in the wake of that, in the wake of that event, of course, what we know much of what happened in this community. And of course, you know, on this anniversary, you know, the question kind of comes up of where are we when it comes to some of these really vexing and difficult issues. Do you feel like we're making any headway?
I am not directly involved day-to-day in the political life of the community. I am to some extent in the social life. I do rely on the Kenosha News, which remains, like other local newspapers, an excellent resource. And I've been impressed at the degree to which people from different communities, not just racially, but socially and economically, have been working very hard together to try to improve community relations. Johnny Kasperzak, a young man with Down syndrome, who's a great admirer of the police and law enforcement, is someone who has been, along with a lot of other people with various disabilities, there's been an effort by the police department that's always there, but my impression is more than in the past to be helpful to him and provide him with a satisfying life. It was a front page story on the Kenosha News, which is why I know about it. I think communication along with concrete plans are important. We're all blessed and fortunate that this hasn't recurred. One question that comes to mind, when did you last have someone from law enforcement on the morning show, from the police department or the county sheriff's office?
A few months ago, we actually had two law enforcement officials who are involved in the police training program here at Gateway. We had a very, very interesting conversation.
Good. From Kenosha?
Yes.
Good.
And, or here in southeastern Wisconsin, and specifically talking about the ways in which law enforcement officials are trained nowadays, and in particular, how they are trained to deal with these situations when they arrive. And we had a very, very good conversation that I would encourage people to seek out in the morning show archives.
Good.
And we need to have more conversations like that.
Yeah, that would be one practical way of recognizing the first anniversary, including bringing in women and men who are in uniform from the Kenosha Police Department, the county sheriff, and the state police, but especially Kenosha, and for that matter, Racine Police. Good for you. Keep it up.
Dr. Art Sear, Clawson DeSinger's Professor of Political Economy and World Business, we appreciate you joining us today on the morning show for this conversation and look forward to having you back. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure and a tonic. Thank you, sir.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be talking to the author of a very interesting book called The Quiet Zone. We're talking about a region of West Virginia, Green Bank, West Virginia in particular, where it is, at least technically speaking, against the law to operate a smartphone or to have Wi-Fi. It is a radio quiet zone put in place because of a nearby radio observatory. Stephen Kurtze visited Green Bank, West Virginia, and actually spent considerable time there and wrote a book then about this community called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. On Wednesday, I speak with a reporter for The Washington Post, Yasmin Abutaleb, who covers health policy for The Washington Post. She is the co-author of a book called Nightmare Scenario, Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. On Thursday, Kelly Scroggins-Powell joins us for the first time. She is executive director of a newly formed group called Racine Women for Racial Justice. And on Friday, Christopher Clary writes a book about, has written a book about one of the greatest athletes in the world, tennis genius Roger Federer. Christopher Clary's book about him is called The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. You can also subscribe to the morning show as a podcast, and then you hear a different morning show 7 days a week. And for instance, this past weekend, you can hear my interview from 2008 with Dallas Murphy, the author of To Follow the Water, which examines the health of the seven seas. Also this past weekend, I reran an interesting interview from 1998 with Miss Kenosha 1998, Joya Zamora, who takes us kind of behind the scenes of the world of pageants. You can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast via all the major podcast providers, Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast. Make sure you look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. We're approaching 9 o'clock.